Neither of those authors has sent me a copy of the book. And I hope you're watching on Spotify. That's not making the cut. Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
And Neil Almond.
Hello.
We're going to round off our three-part mini-series on the future of assessment at Key Stage 1 by exploring writing assessment and what the future might hold. But first, Chris, what you reading for?
Hey, what you reading for?
Today, specifically, I've been reading Alcibel's Meaningful Learning in Action by a friend of the podcast and just brilliant person, Sarah Cottingham. You'll know her on Twitter as @overpracticed. We've discussed the book in the past. Or the writing of the book, the thoughts that went into it. So if you haven't already listened to that podcast with Sarah on, then go back and check that out. You will immediately understand why this book is so essential and why hers is a voice that is well worth listening to. You don't need me to say how brilliant it is, though it is possibly the highlight of my career that I was asked to write the foreword. So please check it out. It is brilliant. What about you, Neil? What are you reading for?
So again, sticking to the theme of friends of the podcast, I was very fortunate to receive a copy of Mr. T Does Primary History. So that's the one and only Mr. Stuart Tiffany. So obviously being the history buffs that kind of we are, I was really kind of excited to have a look at his offering into kind of this space. I think it's probably the first kind of real like subject specific primary based book on the market I can probably think of for something that's not a core subject. And so I think it's a perfect little addition for any history lead new to it, seasoned veteran, just to get their head around what it is that the national curriculum actually asks for, his approach to teaching of history. And he just kind of rounds it all off with like lots of theory leading up to it. And then just kind of like two really nice, clear work examples that he kind of then, breaks down for you in the book. So a real sort of theoretical, practical match made in heaven for tackling the planning, the teaching, the leading of primary history. What about you, Kieran? What are you reading for?
So you guys don't have a what you're reading for. I've got one. I've been reading Craig Latimer's recent blog post called Problem Solving, Kind of. And it was part of a talk that he gave at MathsConf 32 and at the Primary Maths Conference in June. Craig's a real deep thinker about his practice and about the practice of others. I mean, I think he did 3 hours and 8 minutes with Craig Barton recently on the Mr. Barton Maths podcast. So anyone who can go that long into the planning of mathematics lessons, I think clearly thinks about their practice a lot. So well worth checking out. And he's on Twitter at @teach_solutions. This week we're going to round off our series on the future of assessment at Key Stage 1. Makes sense to start where we always do, with definitions. What did Key Stage 1 writing, SATs and moderation entail? And what was the impact?
It entailed, there was no obviously formalized sort of writing SAT like there used to be at Key Stage 2, in the sense of, here's a cold task effectively, but there was still, no longer, thankfully, that moderation process that I'm sure anyone who has been in year 6 or in year 2 has gone through it realizes what an absolute joke that process is. So again, teacher assessment framework, kids need to be able to do ABC, things like beginning to use subordinate clauses in their writing, to begin to write complex sentences at the age of 7, consistent use of tenses and things, all a manner of things that are, you know, are absolutely fair. And some things that I think personally rushed that process of writing. And it usually was because there was this kind of expectation in terms of a quantity of writing done, and that usually as a full narrative. And so you'd get children who really still don't understand basic sentence structure, you know, having to write maybe half a page story based on, you know, something that they know, but just the absolute cognitive processing that's actually required to do that just meant that pupils ended up embedding really, really bad habits in terms of basic punctuation, basic sentence structures just not being there at all. But, you know, hoops have been jumped through. So, you know, they come up to you in year 3 as an expected writer when, again, you know, they're still kind of really struggling with the basics. So the impact was a lot of falsified data that really didn't reflect the actual attainment of the pupils that were going through that process and that system, which then really just kind of set the conveyor belt properly in motion, I think, anyway.
I think something that's worth mentioning as well is the sense of the undermining of professionalism that often comes alongside teacher assessments because of the pressure, as you say, to nudge certain percentages in certain directions. So just as common as it is for teachers perhaps in year 6 to try and say, like, well, how high can we get this number? Sometimes if, say, you are working in a primary school and you're looking in particular at your progress from kind of key stage 1 to key stage 2, there are, I've heard on the grapevine, sometimes discussions that go something along the lines of, what number are you after? What percentage of pupils at the expected standards are we looking to have? And then reverse engineering kind of the numbers of pupils who are at that stage in order to fit that number. And even if you put aside, not that we should, but even if you put aside the impact that that potentially has on pupils because of inaccurate assessment, what that and the teaching that comes as a result of that, we have to think about what that does to the morale of the profession, the sense of purpose of those who are working in schools when they are asked to do these things that are so misaligned with, you know, the underlying aims of presumably why they came into the profession in the first place. Obviously, writing is so heavily attached to spoken language development that, you know, you can't really separate the two out fully. But because there is this massive focus on lengthier texts, on producing mini narratives or retelling of events was quite common, or bits of poetry or whatever it might be. Often, as Neil said, there was a push towards that, lots of lengthier writing. And it meant that we were effectively saying to kids, look, if your spoken language development is in a good place, so you're pretty good at thinking through and constructing a sentence orally and then getting it down on paper, you'll be fine. And if you're not so strong at that, if that's not where you're at yet, we still want you to do that. We still want you just to kind of get on paper some reflection of how you talk. And often the short version is that we ended up making writers or young writers write things incorrectly or stuff that just didn't make sense to them or to anyone else who would read it, over and over and over and over and over again. And there were lots of bits and pieces relating to handwriting, spelling, sentence development, where you look at writers who come up in year 3 and you think, you know what, for some of the instruction you've had, I think you would have been better off not doing any. I think you would have been better off with just less teaching, because embedding something wrong is often worse than just doing nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I once had a colleague tell me about the influx of infant school pupils into their year 3 class. And obviously, they don't need to worry about progress. So they're trying to get that attainment as high as possible. And this is back in the days when you had level three. And a level three in infant school, I mean, a level three in year two in general, was not a level three in primary school, was not a level three in year three. So, you know, that was quite a difficult year for them. And I remember them telling me about it and just how stressful it was. Because like you say, conveyor belt, you know, they were trying to rush and they're all, this kid came in year two, they're legally officially down as a 2B. They need to be at level four by the end of year six, you know, by hook or by crook. So yeah, so definitely caused a lot of issues. I think as a species, maybe we haven't cracked writing. You know, books like Sarah's shouldn't be outliers. You know, you read Sarah's work and you think, oh my goodness, this is so well written. And it's not some gene. It's just that Sarah happens to have mastered the English language. And I count myself among the people who have not yet mastered the English language. Because it should be the norm that everyone writes with clarity and precision. And something is a miss in the teaching of writing in general, that it seems as if these people are wonderfully talented. And Sarah is fantastically talented and hardworking. So this is not me trying to take away from her. It just happens to be a pertinent example of when a book is written really, really well, you know? And so this feels like an opportunity to really take advantage of this and put things in place that will allow all writers or all people to be able to write effectively.
Agreed. And I think just going back to the teacher assessment framework just for a moment, you know, naturally that suffers from the same drawbacks that any sort of best fit framework suffers in terms of the actual then assessment of it. You know, the moderators would be coming in and their idea of what a simple coherent narrative about personal experience and those of others, real or fictional, what their interpretation, what that actually means to be working at the expected standard, you know, varies completely from what you know, another moderator who might have come and joined you in, you know, some sort of parallel universe. So it is really one that a lot of work can you know, be put in place, I think, to ensure that actually, you know, we might, you know, go slow a little bit with the understanding, again, it's that Daisy Christodoulou marathon analogy. You don't train for a marathon by running a marathon. You do lots of short incremental bursts of running. You might do some weight training. That doesn't look anything like what running a marathon actually does. You might look at your diet as well to make sure, you know, that side of it is all ready for it. And so I think, you know, writing is fits that analogy really quite well. And say without this checkpoint at key stage one, there is potential for the profession to, you know, perhaps do something about it.
You've almost alluded to it there, Neil, about the answer to the next question, because I think we're reasonably aligned in terms of what our response might be. How might we teach writing in year two?
So the first thing I would say is that I think there's a mindset shift that is necessary in primary writing. Certainly, if I reflect on how I taught writing when I was in year two, how I taught writing beyond that as well. And I spent a lot of that time assuming, partly because of these moderation processes, I think, assuming that the unit of expression and the unit that was required in order to express yourself and to enjoy doing so was the text. So I needed to write a text in order to have any sort of fulfillment in writing, and anything smaller than that, you know, a sentence, a paragraph, something, a chunk of a text, anything less than a whole text was inevitably somewhat, I don't want to say joyless, but yeah, joyless and not as important in terms of learning as this thing I was building towards. Good writers are those who are really good at constructing texts, was the thing I was thinking about. And you'll have heard me say it before on this podcast, I suspect, but I think that that is just the wrong way to think about writing. I think that one of the key things we need to think about is sentence construction, it's phrase, clause, and sentence construction. And not only teaching that as like the building blocks of something bigger, but teaching them as joyous, meaningful units in and of themselves. And I think that has a big impact in something like year two, when we can start to say, well, today we're going to be thinking about writing particular kinds of sentences, or developing certain kinds of sentences, or talking of trying to communicate a certain thing with types of sentences. And instead of thinking of that as, you know, a building block towards something inevitably better, but thinking of that instead as, well, this is what we're learning today, this is what we want to get good at. Being able to do this is what good writers do, just as much, if not more so, than their ability to kind of structure a larger text, to structure a narrative. So in short, if I had like one big idea I want to get across, so in terms of year two writing, and dare I say beyond, it's this idea that we think about sentences as like the fundamental unit of meaning, and we teach how to write those, not just as, oh, okay, these are exercises, I want to be able to write this kind of sentence and this kind of sentence, but we teach those as, okay, how expressive can we be? How interesting can we be? What's the difference between this sentence when you write it this way and this way? And I think from that, we start to get into all the interesting stuff like editing, proofreading, that kind of stuff, and in quite a natural fashion, rather than dropping children at the deep end of doing that once they're writing whole texts.
Yeah, I agree completely with what you're saying. It's really about stripping it back to its bare bones and, you know, enjoying that process. And, you know, I think you can make the analogy with reading. It's, you know, we read to enjoy whole texts, of course we do, but, you know, children get a lot of joy from being able to read one word. They get a lot of joy from being able to read, you know, a sentence, and bloody hell, they get even more joy when they read back a sentence that they've actually written. So, you know, absolutely understanding that that is the absolute key. But I think, you know, behind that, I think we also need to appreciate, I think we do on some level, but perhaps not taken perhaps as seriously as perhaps it should be, but handwriting, the act of actually being able to hold that pen or pencil correctly, getting that to that, you know, we talk about fluency again in reading, but actually getting our handwriting fluent to the point of automaticity, so that actually I can spend and that cognitive space in thinking about what I want to write and not thinking, gosh, I need to remember how to form this particular you know, letter or whatever it might be. And so, you know, something again I'm looking at, we're looking at, is actually, you know, let's strip it back even more perhaps, and let's make sure that, you know, handwriting is just some sort of incidental calming activity that we get the kids to do after break or lunch or whatever, you know, and it's just a bit of paper, you know, crack on. But, you know, we give the act of, you know, teaching handwriting the respect that it needs to ensure that, you know, for me it almost is like the phonics screening check. You know, I need to know that you can actually you know, write, I'm not, you know, not necessarily legibly, but, you know, fluently enough without, you know, conscious effort, that to the point where you can spend that, let's say, those cognitive resources thinking about what you want to write. So definitely word, phrase, clause, sentence, paragraph. But even before that, you know, thinking about, are we ready to write with regards to handwriting? And as I say, we could go on for ages on this one, but I think that's something I'll put in the table and then be interested to hear what others have to say on that one.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, when I remember taking Sylvia into school when I was working in year two, she helped me out with some tray labels and this sort of thing one long morning. And we were looking at English books that had come up from year one. And she was astonished at the idea that even at the end of year one, pupils were writing loads of stuff. And I asked her about what was going on in Slovakia at this point with kids this age. And she was saying, well, they've basically just about, so they've either just arrived at school or they've been at school for a little while. And at this stage, a lot of that focus will be on handwriting. And what I actually asked about, you know, what that looked like. And I got to see some of these Slovak books. And a lot of it is initially shapes and swirls and patterns. And every pupil in the class is getting to a stage where they can do that beautifully. And it's just like initially it's taught, it's modeled, but it's also done in quite an enjoyable way. And then once that's embedded, then they're looking at how to form letters and et cetera. And it's not dissimilar to what we do, but it's often the stuff that we do with pupils only who are struggling. We wait until they struggle with handwriting and stuff. And then we're like, oh, actually, maybe there are some exercises to support X, Y, and Z. But the key thing is these foundations are treated with the respect that they deserve. Those foundations that you mentioned, like handwriting, like the very early elements of spelling. And then what's fascinating is that as a result, they seem like the writing that they seem to be able to do, seems to be, from Sylvia's description and from discussions I've had with the equivalent of primary teachers over there, despite the fact that they've been at school for significantly shorter amount of time, the actual writing that they produce is at least comparable to what pupils in kind of year 5 and 6 will be producing over here when they're at the same age. So I totally agree about the importance of embedding these foundations. And one of the things that you've mentioned there, and we've discussed in the past alongside handwriting, spelling as foundations, are the basics of subject and verb. I don't mean that in a tedious EGPS, just labeling in effect. But teaching that in the same way that we might teach, you know, morphology as a way of thinking about understanding our language. You know, this is how sentences work, or this is how many sentences work. So getting to a stage where you can have a lesson with pupils, where you have a little activity, say, where you say, okay, someone pick me a subject. What are we going to write about? You know, and several hands go up. Someone suggests a bear. And then someone says, okay, give us a verb. What's this bear going to be doing? Maybe no hands go up. So the teacher, you know, finds a verb or finds a picture of a bear doing something, perhaps picking berries or disturbing a beehive or whatever it might be, and then says, okay, we've got a subject, we've got a verb, it's this and this, where are you taking the rest of that sentence? And embedding that language into year two and making it like sentence construction all about meaning from the beginning, all about what's the thing we're talking about, what is it doing, or is it existing, or what is it possessing, if we're using, you know, to have or to be verbs. And then from that, let's build a sentence from there, rather than what often happens, which is the idea of pupils kind of creating sentences from scratch without this discussion of meaning and structure that allows them to build something more complex over time.
Are you both familiar with colorful semantics?
Yeah, I've come across it.
Yeah, I would wager quite heavily that if every primary school up and down the country stopped like their current practice and just adopted colourful semantics on a whole class level, that the quality of the writing by the end of primary school certainly would not suffer at all, because colourful semantics is, as you say, a way of visually being able to represent that subject verb pattern that's ingrained in many of the sentences that we do, and they just associate it with colors. So verb might be green, the subject might be orange, different cards, let's just put them in, you know, go crazy, make some silly sentences, which ones match, which ones don't match. You know, you then get your perhaps an adjective in there, which might be blue. And then you think about, you move where the blue card goes. And so we can have, you know, the big bear ran, or we could have, you know, so then they might move it away and move the blue to perhaps the beginning. Big, the bear ran, doesn't make sense. So, you know, lots of interesting ways that I think you can teach that, which isn't, as you say, that EGPS heavy, you know, here's the sentence. Now I want you to underline the verb, circle the subject, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that's where it teaches. It's an intervention. And that's the thing that makes me laugh as well, is that colourful semantics is usually an intervention for those children in about year three, possibly year two, who aren't doing well at writing. But actually, they're not doing well at writing because we don't necessarily teach the thing that colourful semantics aims to try and do, which is obviously, you know, subject-verb agreement, effectively. It's, yeah, quite an interesting one.
I remember when we were, 2012 curriculum, well, it was 2014, but in 2012, we could see the draft and we knew where we were going. So obviously there was a lot of writing of long-term plans and things. I remember having a conversation. I mean, it must have been 4 or 5 years into my career at the time. And it was, well, what's our long-term plan for English? And I was all, well, the grammar section of the national curriculum is our long-term plan. And it amazes me that to this day, text types still dominate that kind of plan. And I just don't know, you know, because there were obviously text types named in the previous incarnation of the curriculum. But with their removal, I thought that would release the shackle somewhat, but it just didn't seem to catch on. What we're generally saying is that we need to be explicit about the component parts of the English language that we want to teach. And we need to give pupils the opportunity to explore them regularly so that until they get to the point of automaticity or fluency with them.
Yeah, and an example of that, I want to see kids learning how to redraft, edit, proofread, etc. I want to see them doing that on the sentence level. I want pupils to have the opportunity to do that on the sentence level and have done that on the sentence level loads before they're ever asked to do that for a whole paragraph. And then I want to see them have the chance to do that with a whole paragraph quite a lot before we're beginning to say, okay, look at a whole text. I don't think that's necessarily what happens in most schools. I saw some of the best writing lessons I ever saw in Key Stage 1, or upper, sort of year 2, and actually kind of lower key stage 2 as well, involved teachers asking pupils to start with a sentence, to write a sentence, and then to say, okay, we're now going to write a better version of that sentence. And they'll do that together. The teacher will, you know, do some modeling, will talk about what they're trying to communicate with that sentence, what they're trying to say. So there's this embedded idea of audience and purpose, even on the sentence level. So they'll do that and they'll model it and they'll do that with one sentence. And then they'll let kids free with something like that and say, okay, we've got another picture or another icon or whatever it might be. I want you to talk about that. We've got our subject, we've got our verb. We want to explore this sentence. Once you've written it, you're going to share it either with me, with a partner, etc. And then you're going to have another go at it. You're going to make it more, not just more interesting or better, but we're going to think about our audience. We're going to think about our purpose and then go, what might make this sentence more effective in achieving that? What might make it more effective in communicating what you want it to communicate with the audience? And sometimes seeing a sentence, even year 2 or year 3, go through 2 or 3 iterations until pupils have got a sentence where they're really, you know, they're chuffed with it. It's they're happy with the spelling, they're happy with their vocabulary choices, they're certain with the punctuation, that kind of stuff. That early proofreading, that early focus on a sentence is a block of meaning, and there's it can be, you know, a really central part of writing is to focus on that construction. Is, yeah, I know I'm kind of reiterating what I said earlier, but there are just so many ways that you can embed this into your practice in a meaningful way.
Chris mentioned, I think, like icons or pictures. GIFs are fantastic. And I think we mentioned this a while back when we talked about writing, but obviously for perhaps children who perhaps struggle to come up with sentences from static pictures, you know, GIFs are really, really useful because obviously they contain an action, usually just a short little action that obviously then that can just help direct pupils' attention. So definitely, definitely don't be shy about using the GIFs.
On to the big question. How might we assess writing in year 2 now that these restrictions have been removed and we've got the freedom to do essentially what we would like to and what we think is best for our pupils?
So I would definitely include some sort of, we do fluency checks for reading. I would definitely include some sort of handwriting fluency check to see whether, you know, they might need some intervention at some point later on down the line, like we do with reading. You might want to do that perhaps, you know, once or twice a year to kind of just have to check that there is kind of progress being involved in that. Pretty biased, bit of skin in the game perhaps, but obviously at STEP we have a pretty decent structure, sentence structure curriculum, and we would just kind of base it around whether children can do some of these simple things that you know, we've talked about. If provided with a GIF/GIF, you know, can children write an accurate sentence demonstrating mastery of, you know, a full stop, a capital letter, perhaps a question mark if we teach that. I think we teach that at Key State. Yeah, we do, you know, question mark, whatever it might be. So, you know, making it really kind of clear what it is that you are expecting. Some of the issues with the teacher assessment framework was things like use coordination. It provides a few examples, but just kind of as examples, you know, to join some clauses together. Well, we're quite explicit that the coordinating conjunctions that we want pupils to see in from year one through to year two are these certain ones. So I want to see that children actually are capable of, you know, doing that at the sentence level. Beyond that, if I think I've taught year three once, if I had children coming up from year two and they really knew what a sentence was, subject, verb, perhaps throw in a few adjectives there, and they understand how, you know, the position of the adjective, and I knew that their stop marks were accurate, I'd be very happy taking that as a base.
I think one of the big questions around the assessment of writing is, when does it become useful? Because obviously, if we're talking year two, in a lot of cases, we are talking about pupils putting thoughts to paper who are in a position where they struggle to read back those thoughts. And I think it's often really difficult to judge where a pupil is likely to be at in their trajectory on writing if their reading capabilities have not put them in a position where part of writing is, you know, looking at their own writing, working out what's going on, where there isn't that kind of personal feedback loop, so that they can't, oh no, that doesn't make sense, I can change that, or I don't like that word in that place, I'm going to do that. If they're not at the stage where they can do that, I think it's really, really difficult to assess where they're at for their writing, or where they're at least on their trajectory to somewhere better. So I think if someone said to me, I'm a year three teacher and I've got kids coming up, and they say, I want you to take a guess at where these kids are going to be at in year six for their writing, I would look at their handwriting, I'd probably take a little look at their spelling, and I would think about their what's their reading fluency assessment, what was their phonics screening check. I would say that those would be the things, actually, in terms of me predicting where these kids are going to be, thinking about where they are in the developmental trajectory in terms of writing. I think those would be the things that are most informative. However, if I'm thinking more about on a formative level, what is it that I want to be able to add to this child's repertoire? How can I best support this individual, this group, this class? Then I'm absolutely, of course, thinking about the things that Neil's described. I'm thinking about, you know, okay, are they aware of conjunctions in their writing? Are they punctuating as habit? I'm not that fussed about the idea of whether pupils know to use the correct punctuation when it comes to the basics of sentence punctuation, like full stop, capital letter. I think that's much more habit. And then there's knowledge around the way that sentences work. I think we often, you know, get into quite a lot of confusion about things like full stop, capital letter. I think mostly that is, there is a basic understanding of sentence structure there. There's knowledge that comes from reading, but a lot of that is just ingrained habits. So I'm less worried about that in year three in terms of knowledge than I am in terms of habit. Are they just in the habit of like putting a capital letter at the start of the sentence? Are they in the habit of putting a capital letter for their name rather than, oh, do they know exactly why they're putting a capital letter at the start of a sentence? Yeah, or why they're putting a capital letter for their name. Habits, I think, are as important as knowledge at that point. But in short, if I'm thinking summative stuff, I'm actually possibly looking elsewhere apart from, I'm looking at reading stuff as well as handwriting and spelling. If I'm thinking formative stuff, I'm absolutely thinking about the stuff Neil's mentioned there in terms of sentence construction as well.
Nice. I like this because it means that there's going to be a lot of time saved for teachers with just a slight realignment of our priorities, perhaps. We can then dedicate time to those things that we know are more likely to be both indicative of where we want them to be in the future, but also support us in the moment with the kinds of formative assessment that we know can be really, really powerful.
Just one thing that I think can be a useful assessment as well on top of this stuff, in the same way that like a comprehension assessment in reading gives you just a little flavor of lots of different things, I think that looking at pupils' attitudes to writing gives you potentially gives you a little flavor of lots of different things. Because often if a pupil says, oh, I don't like it, or they demonstrate an aversion to writing, it's often like a warning sign that perhaps actually they're gripping their pen too tight, so it hurts when they write for a significant period of time, or they just really struggle with it compared to their peers, or they don't like the way that their writing looks. And so there are little confidence issues there that you might need to deal with. I think getting a little handle on how a pupil just feels about a subject is always important. I think it's kind of especially important in writing because of the way that, like reading, it ends up being so tightly tied to a pupil's sense of self-efficacy.
Just think about all those things that you mentioned there and kind of before, Chris, and it's kind of just come to me right now. So we might cut this because you're going to tell me it's a rubbish idea, but I think dictation, like little dictation exercises, actually fulfills a lot of this criteria in the sense of that habit of where they put the punctuation, handwriting fluency, their kind of initial response to when you say, we're going to do a little dictation exercise now, children. And when they all inevitably go, or some might go, yay. I think it kind of hits and obviously your, goes back, we said about spelling as well. Obviously, you can make sure that that's pretty phonetically controlled in terms of the sound spelling correspondences that, that you've taught those pupils. So I feel like, yeah, some sort of dictating a few sort of coherent, maybe four or five coherent sentences together actually might do a lot of this work for you, which is pretty easy. Easy on the teacher, I think. Happy for you to tell me that actually I'm overthinking this.
No, I love that. What I love about dictation is the way that you can isolate components of writing. So I mentioned like full stop capital letter a moment ago and how I'm interested in the habits that are around that. When you dictate sentences and say, okay, I'd like you to write this, it's amazing how many pupils who you thought were all over the place with full stop capital letter are suddenly quite strong with full stop capital letter because they're not having to think about what words they're choosing. So you recognize then that, oh, actually this full stop capital letter thing, it isn't an ingrained habit yet, but they know what they're doing with it. They know that sentences need to begin with a full stop capital letter. And when they don't do it, it's because their working memory is overwhelmed with all the other stuff you've got to do at the same time. And so much of writing, we end up assessing and going, they can't do this and they can't do this and they can't do this. And actually in isolation, they can possibly do all of those things. It's just, it's too much in terms of working memory. So it isn't, as I mentioned earlier, potentially in a lot of cases, a knowledge issue. It's just that enough of these things, be it spelling, punctuation, etc., aren't embedded, aren't kind of habits enough yet, they're not unconsciously competent enough in these things yet, that when you try and ask them to do them all at the same time, they get them all wrong. And so our assessment can end up being a bit, iffy. Isolating components through things like dictation is a great way to work out whether kids actually do potentially have issues in their full stop capital letter, or actually whether that's an issue just related to how cognitively overwhelming writing can be when you're at the early stages.
Nice. I think you're spot on, Neil. That's such a great idea. It's definitely not getting cut. I mean, the physical act of writing is really, really tough. I remember, I don't know if this is still a thing, but at university we had to do like these 3-hour exams and we had to write essays during the exam at the end of the year. And I think that's when my handwriting peaked and my ability to write peaked, because I couldn't go half a page without going, oh, this is an absolute pain in the neck. I do not want to be doing this. Maybe it's because computers are more prevalent now. So I think activities like that, where they're short, sharp, and they're focused, really allow you to get the most from your pupils, while also saving them the burden of having to write a ton of stuff by hand. I don't know. Maybe we should write more by hand, but I'm not convinced. So I think we've just got time for one more. And potentially what happens next, what goes well, could be a blueprint for Key States 2, where we know a lot of the things that we talked about at the start, a lot of the ills in the system still exist. And you could almost take your responses about what the impact was of Key Stage 1, writing moderation, and superimpose a question about Key Stage 2, and you probably find very similar answers. Should it be a blueprint? And if so, what might it look like?
I think it provides perhaps, you know, the first part of a blueprint. I don't think you could just kind of scale this up without adding additional complexity to it for Key Stage 2. It seems that we're, you know, kind of in agreement that, say, dictation as a means for assessing is quite a useful thing to do at Key Stage 1. I wouldn't say that that means that there's no use for it at all in Key Stage 2. I'm actually thinking that, you know, some of those bits in the, some of the, you know, use correct punctuation correctly in the teacher assessment framework for Key Stage 2. Yeah, if I'm dictating that sentence and children get it, and they can use punctuation correctly, great. I would personally be happy to say, yeah, they can do that. In the context of, you know, working memory being kind of, you're taking out that kind of the need for to constantly think about their own content. But at the same time, you know, as they progress through the curriculum and they come to learn new sentence structures and they come across, you know, perhaps different text types through their reading canon and things like that, you definitely kind of want to give pupils that little bit more freedom to have you know, to write freely without necessarily, you know, constraints that you are kind of putting on them. To the extent that you still need to keep that quite tight, that's up for debate, I think. And I don't think anyone's really going to. I think you almost have to take that as a case-by-case, class-by-class basis. I've certainly met some, you know, 11-year-olds who are, you know, far better fiction writers than I will probably be. I've made my made my peace with that fact that I'm certainly not going to produce the next bestseller, and I'm not going to be an Oprah's book club anytime soon. But they need that opportunity to do that. Would it be better? I think because of Key Stage 2 moderation, particularly this idea of, you know, greater depth. And to be greater depth, it's just a feeling, isn't it? It's just, you know, you just know it, like, you know, outstanding lessons of old, you know, just I read it and it gave me goosebumps. So therefore it has to be, greater depth. So, yeah, I think that probably you can use it as an initial blueprint, but certainly not just replicable. You need to add that additional complexity that comes from not just your writing curriculum, but from the wider curriculum as well.
In terms of like primary writing, there's so much that we can say that we're not going to have time to talk about it all now. This would end up being a 3 or 4 hour podcast. We'd end up treading old ground. And I've no doubt that if you want to learn more about this, there are podcasts further back in this, in the series that Kieran's put together that will satisfy that urge. But if you'll forgive me for kind of laboring that one key point, one of the things I hear over and over again from teachers up in Key Stage 2, even, you know, secondary school, etc., is that when we start talking about stuff on the sentence level, there's this phrase or something along the lines of, well, this is the stuff they should have mastered further down the school. Like, no, that's not the case. We're always working towards mastery of this stuff, whether we're, you know, 6, 16 or 60. We're still working on the sentence level. We're still getting better on the sentence level. I would argue that possibly 80% of what writing is, and thus 80% of what we're kind of thinking about when we're teaching writing, is improving our ability and pupils' ability to deal with sentences on that level, to communicate sentence by sentence. So if there's one message I'd hammer home, it would be that. Obviously, of course, there are differences between Key Stage 1 and Key Stage 2. We do start to really care a great deal more about pupils' ability to actually think their way through, to structure and to plan in order to achieve that, whole paragraphs and whole texts. It is certainly something we want pupils to be pushed to achieve, because I think kids can still do this stuff in Key Stage 1 and should be encouraged in their own time and perhaps in opportunities in schools to write whole texts, to express themselves in that way. But as an expectation, obviously, that's something that becomes far more prevalent in Key Stage 2. And a big part of that, if there was one other thing I would talk about, and this is true on the sentence level, the paragraph level, and the whole text level, I would be thinking about, as part of this blueprint, how are we using examples and non-examples as productively as we can. So when we're teaching sentences, if we're looking at, you know, how we're going to express this idea, I want to show five or six ways that are equally valid of expressing this idea, and perhaps one that doesn't quite express this idea, but comes close, so that we can start to see what makes an effective sentence, what doesn't, with a little bit more clarity. The same on a paragraph level and the same on the whole text level. So making sure pupils, if you are going to get them to write a whole paragraph on a subject with a particular audience and purpose, don't just show them one model text. Yes, perhaps you want to explore one model text in a bit more depth for the sake of that valuable oral rehearsal. Yes. But in terms of their experience of what this paragraph might look like or this text might look like, if you want them to be creative, if you want them not just to copy what you've done with very slight changes, then they need kind of a breadth of experience. They need a variety of those paragraphs or those texts where we're intentionally thinking about the variation and exploring that variation.
I think you're right. I think we could go on for a long time. And I mean, we have had some really good episodes on writing and assessment in writing. You know, Emma Adam came in and talked about comparative judgment. And I think the three of us might have looked at writing on some level before as well. But within the remit of the series of episodes, you know, the future of Key Stage 1 assessment, I think we've done a pretty good job of succinctly outlining what the options might be for schools, what the reasons for those options are. And now I think it's over to schools. But I think, yeah, let's put a pin in it for now. And we're definitely going to keep an eye out for developments to see how this manifests and how changes manifest, if anything manifests at all. And then definitely review, maybe not in such extensive terms as to have three single episodes dedicated to each of the subjects, but certainly want to see where we are in 2 years' time when we've had a chance for things to bed in, because we started off the series, Neil, you and I talking about, well, what's your prediction for 24 months from now? And now, you know, the clock has now started ticking. All I have to do, guys, is say thank you very much for joining me. Thank you very much, Chris.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Neil.
Been wonderful. Thank you so much.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.